Hello. Let me recapitulate. Last time, I talked about the initial development of farming communities and settled life in central China. The origins of agriculture in this part of Asia. And something I want to emphasize, because this will be important in other areas as well, the implications for archaeologists of different agricultural systems depending on different cereal crops, and in some other parts of the world, not even cereals, but other basic food crops, the ways that these structure the archaeological record because of the difficulty of domestication, differences in productivity of different crops, especially at different points during domestication, and the environments that these crops require. These processes in China then culminated in the appearance of the Longshan tradition. And with the Longshan, we have significant evidence for cultural complexity and for differences in power and wealth within communities. By the late 3rd millennium BC, just before 2000 BC, Longshan culture, in some form, had spread over a significant area of central and northern China. Now, there's discussions, archaeological debates, about whether this was primarily an elite culture outside its homeland region, or whether it was adopted more widely than that. There are several distinct regional variants of this Longshan cultural tradition. In Henan and Shandong, for example, and this elite culture, at any rate the elite culture which spread, seems to have provided a template for the forms of display and ceremonial and the ideologies associated with chiefly rule. It was, in a sense, a way of thinking about how to rule, a set of justifications for rule by the wealthy and powerful, and a variety of agreed upon ways to represent and to display that cultural and political power. This late Longshan culture, in terms of its scale and its characteristics, would equate to the late pre-dynastic period in Egypt, or perhaps to the Uruk period in Mesopotamia. Of course, what we need to remember is when I say that it equates in terms of scale and characteristics, it happens about 1,000 years later. If the pre-dynastic and Uruk periods in Egypt and Mesopotamia respectively happened just before 3000 BC, the equivalent period of the late Longshan is just before 2000 BC. Similar processes were going on in other parts of China at the same time, but we know far less about them, about such developments in, for example, southern China. It would be tremendous if we knew more, and there is archaeological work going on in these other areas of China, but not the time depth of archaeology as we see in central China. This Longshan elite culture then eventually provided an ideological and political model for rule at the state level over large areas of what's now modern China. As in Mesopotamia, and perhaps at least somewhat in contrast to the Nile Valley or the Indus River Valley, developments toward urbanism and statehood in the Huanghe River Valley of central China seems to have been a relatively gradual process involving steady increases in the size of settlements and the complexity of social and political relations. These developments actually quite likely began as far back as Yang Shao times, before 3000 BC. Given the evidence for population growth and for defensive features and thus intercommunity conflict on Yangshao sites. These processes continue through the Longshan period, and late Longshan times, late Longshan culture blends more or less seamlessly into the subsequent Chinese Bronze Age after about 2000 BC. Much later, Chinese historical documents refer to a semi-legendary Xia dynasty, which existed before the historically and archaeologically known Shang dynasty. This Xia dynasty probably correlates to the end of the Longshan period. As we're going to see, there seems to be this gradual shift, this gradual progression through time from Longshan to Xia to Shang. Historical accounts of the Xia dynasty are a great mix of what may be real description along with legendary and semi-legendary characteristics. To give an example, Yu the Great, the first emperor of the Xia dynasty, has a whole variety of stories associated with him, many speaking about the divine favor that was bestowed upon him and his magical feats. In, interestingly enough, taming the rivers through flood control and irrigation systems. This may be a historical memory, refracted down through the generations. It may be a recognition in later times of the importance of irrigation and flood control. Yu the Great is seen as a servant of an earlier emperor, rewarded with the throne himself for his service and for his civil engineering feats. To some extent, the Xia refers to the ritual and ideological preoccupations of the Chinese state almost 2,000 years later with their concern for proper social relations. Despite their semi-legendary nature, these accounts, these historical accounts from much later, from more than 1,000 years later, probably do provide a very distorted, an image at very long range of developments in Longshan elite culture in the Huanghe and Yangtze River valleys. Because, for example, they do take notice of a period when most tools were still made of stone before bronze came into widespread use. The most striking sight that we might associate with this Xia period is a site called Erlido, which was over 900 acres in size and which probably housed more than 20,000 people. Erlido was a true urban center, the first one known in China. Interestingly enough, the site of Erlido does not seem to have been walled. Although the area around the palaces in the center of the site was in fact walled off. Between about 1800 BC and 1600 BC, at the time of Erlido's greatest extent, just more or less post Longshan times, but just barely, palaces were being built on platforms, on the pounded earth platforms that I talked about last time. You can see on this image the palace in the center of the site, Erlido. The largest of these palaces measured about 150 by 50 meters, or approximately 500 by 170 feet. So it was a substantial structure. And there's abundant evidence at Erlido for specialized workshops for the production of pottery, particularly elite pottery, for bronze items, because we're now seeing the appearance and the dissemination of bronze technology, turquoise, and bone tools. So we find these workshops in different parts of the site. in some areas, particularly workshops for elite items associated with the palaces. Extremely rich burials, including items made of jade, silver, and gold, also date from this period, between 1800 and 1600 BC. So this period seems to be one of significant increases in scale of rule, of the architecture and the wealth associated with rule, with urban rule. One important class of findings from Erlido are bronze vessels known as jouets. Now, the six jouets found at Erlido are relatively small and undecorated compared with those that were found in later sites of, for example, the Shang period. But in later times, these and related bronze vessels would be used by rulers and members of the nobility to serve food and wine at ceremonial feasts that both maintained relations between the living and dead ancestors, and also provided opportunities for vassals to demonstrate their relations, to demonstrate fealty to their lords, including the ruler. The presence of these vessels at Erlido suggests that both of these practices, sacrifice and the ceremonialism associated with hierarchy among the nobility, were already part of the culture of rule along the Huanghe River. Characters scratched on pottery found at Erlido seem similar to symbols found in the earliest Chinese writings, the famous oracle bones that were recovered from later Shang dynasty sites. They're not found in at all the same contexts as the oracle bones, and we're going to discuss the origins and development of the Chinese writing system in my next lecture. So it's unclear what their significance is, what the significance of these symbols on ceramics from Erlido actually is. There's not very many of them as well, so it's unclear what position these symbols hold within the development of Chinese writing. All of these data suggest that leaders at Erlido had crossed a socio-political threshold. These leaders were now kings of a Chinese state living in an urban capital. I mentioned last time debates about whether the political systems in the late Longshan period were chiefdoms or not, that perennial question. But it seems fairly clear that by the time of Erlido, between 1800 and 1600 BC, we have a Chinese state. The extent, the territory of that state remains unknown. Although smaller sites with similar ceramics, similar pottery, and similar material culture, albeit for the most part without equivalent luxury goods, are found in Hainan and southern Shanxi provinces. So these may represent other settlements, perhaps ruled from Erlido. Erlido's power seems to collapse by about 1600 BC. For unknown reasons. Although parts of the site were occupied in later times, it must have, during these later times, had a much smaller and essentially commoner population. At the same time, a new walled town, Yanxi, was built only 6 kilometers or just 4 miles away, and it's difficult to escape the conclusion that Yanxi supplanted Erlido in some way. There's no evidence of destruction necessarily at Erlido. So what we may have is a succession of capitals, one from another. Archaeologists have sometimes argued about whether Erlido represents the very end of the Longshan tradition, a separate Xia dynasty, or the beginnings of the Shang state. Now, to a great extent, these distinctions do not matter very much. There seems to be a significant degree of cultural continuity through these times, from probably at least 2500 BC to 1600 BC, and especially in elite culture. There are increases in scale, there's elaboration of elite culture, but we can really trace this as a continuous development through time. There's been a good deal of controversy about when the Shang dynasty actually began, based on a problem that we've already run into in a variety of situations before, different historical estimations of dynasty and reign lengths, and also some different archaeological results. However, the beginning of the Shang is conventionally dated to about 1600 BC, that is about the time that Erlido was abandoned, and its end, the end of the Shang dynasty, to 1046 BC. The reason that I use an exact date in the latter case and not an approximation is because this latter date has in fact been determined through historical sources, and there seems to be at least some degree of agreement between these sources that 1046 is the time of the fall of the Shang. As with the archaeology of state development in other parts of the world, research in China has been severely burdened by an obsession with capitals and elite artifacts. The archaeology of the Shang, of the Shang dynasty, is thus to a great degree an archaeology of urban centers and capitals. It's been estimated that 90% or more of the artifacts used to study the Shang dynasty come from excavations at the last Shang capital at Yinzhou. And in many ways, this is a highly unsatisfactory situation. If we're interested in studying the development of the Shang, it's not a good thing if all our archaeological research comes from the very end of the period, or almost all of our archaeological research comes from the very end of this period. We have to work with what we've got at this point. The initial stage of the Shang, around 1600 BC, is probably best represented by the archaeological site of Erligang, near modern Zhengzhou, and occupied between about 1650 and 1400 BC. So there's a little bit of overlap between the end of the occupation at Erlido and the beginning of the occupation of Erligang, but in fact that is more or less within the uncertainty of radiocarbon dates. Erligang was a large site with two components. First, an immense walled area that seems to have housed members of the elite population of Erligang. And second, a constellation of commoner habitation areas, workshops, and cemeteries distributed over an area of about 40 square kilometers or 1,000 acres around the walled area. This distributed settlement pattern leads some archaeologists to call Erligang and the succeeding Shang sites, which had similar layouts, urban clusters rather than real cities. Chinese urban centers after the Shang would be much more compact and look like those in many other areas of the world. There's been a good deal of debate, a good deal of discussion among archaeologists about the processes that would have led to this Shang settlement pattern at Erligang and other sites. It's been suggested, for example, that this was a way to accommodate migrants from different ethnic groups, possibly engaged in different craft activities. Each group could occupy a separate settlement area within the larger urban cluster. We do see associations between particular settlement areas and particular craft activities. The implication, of course, as well, of this picture of settlement at Early Gang is that Early Gang would be a multi-ethnic, potentially multilingual community on a larger scale equivalent to some of those in, for example, Mesopotamia. The area enclosed by the wall at Early Gang measured almost 800 acres. The wall was about 9 meters or 30 feet high and 36 meters or 120 feet wide at its base. It was built of pounded earth using this technique that I've already referred to, very common technique for building these sort of structures in China. And rough estimates indicated it would have taken 10,000 workers working about 330 days a year, almost 18 years to finish constructing this wall. This makes the Early Gang Wall easily the most massive undertaking, the most massive engineering project, if you like, in China to that point. Many of the ancient remains at Early Gang have been destroyed or obscured by the modern city of Zhengzhou. But the architecture and artifacts that have been found are recognizably akin, recognizably related to those found earlier at Early Do. So we're seeing, again, that development through time, continuous development through time. The best known of the Shang capitals is probably Yinzhu, which was occupied between about 1400 BC, after Early Gang, and the end of the Shang dynasty in, as I said, 1046 BC. Like Early Gang, Yinzhu is also the site of a modern city, Anyang, which again complicates archaeological research. If we have a modern, occupied, busy city sitting on top of an archaeological site, it's difficult to do much archaeology, to open up the large areas that we need in order to understand these ancient urban areas. Excavations at Anyang in the 1920s provided the first real proof, the first real archaeological proof that the Shang dynasty had existed, that the dynasty was not mythical. Unlike Early Gang, the elite and ritual center of Yinzhu was not surrounded by a wall. The reason for this difference, why we find walls in some of these cases and not in others, is unknown. This elite center of the city generally resembles that at Early Gang, with more elaborate palaces and temples on pounded earth platforms. The same constellations of commoner households, workshops, and cemeteries surround this central elite area. One of the most important archaeological discoveries at Yinzhu was a burial complex, which included 1,222 small graves and 13 large royal burials. These tombs are extremely elaborate. Archaeologists have estimated that each of the tombs would have taken about 7,000 working days to dig. So a substantial amount of communal labor required for each of these tombs. The best known of these Shang tombs at Yinzhu is cross-shaped, with sloping ramps 10 meters or about 33 feet deep, and a surface area of 61 by 45 feet. The tomb had been looted at some point in the past, but parts of the burial chambers and some grave goods, especially bronze vessels, including a particular type of sacrificial vessel called a ding, and weapons survived. There were also large numbers of human sacrifices associated with these and other Shang elite tombs. Again, we come back to this issue of human sacrifice. Perhaps the closest analogies to these Shang period tombs are the royal tombs at Ur in Mesopotamia from about 1,000 years earlier, in their size and complexity, in the richness of grave goods originally incorporated in them, and in the practice of human sacrifice. The contrast of these Chinese graves, the Ur graves, with the archaeology of Harappan urbanism, my last case, is extremely striking, isn't it? Where we had no graves of rulers, where we had no human sacrifice. In comparing the Nile Valley and Mesopotamia, in an earlier lecture, I talked about Bruce Trigger's analysis of the difference between territorial states and city-states. In Trigger's terms, Shang China, during the Yinzhu period, seems to be a large-scale territorial state, not a set of city-states, although it's possible that those might have existed around the peripheries of this Shang state. As in the Longshan period, the area of Shang influence was probably much greater than the area actually ruled, controlled by the Shang state. And we can imagine this large, wealthy, powerful state having significant influence well beyond its borders. Other populations, other peoples living around it would have taken note of this. Texts from the Zhou dynasty, just after the Shang, do mention other states outside the middle Huanghe River Valley, where we find the Shang cities. States like Shu in the southwest, Jin in the northwest, Ji to the east, and so on. We know very little about these other states beyond the Shang archaeologically. As I noted, to some degree, our view of Chinese state formation is distorted by a concentration of research at Yinzhu, at Anyang. It's wonderful to have that research, but we should know far more about other areas beyond the Shang capitals. One of the characteristics of early territorial states, Egypt, for example, is the movement of capitals from one place to another. This seems to have been true in China as well, with the successive importance of Erlido, Yanxi, Erligang, and Yinzhu. The problem is that archaeologists' concentration on urban archaeology leaves it rather unclear what these centers were capitals of and how the Shang state was constructed politically. Where were other population centers in the Shang state? We have some possibilities, but nothing particularly well established. Some sources, some historical sources, have concluded that Shang had two capitals simultaneously, one for government and one as a ritual center connected with relations to the ancestors. Is that likely? Were there administrative divisions or provinces within the state, the equivalent of the Egyptian nomes? Presumably for governmental purposes, there would have been. If so, how were they run? Was this a feudal state, as would become the case in the succeeding Zhou dynasty, or was it more highly centralized? Did the Shang state incorporate, perhaps through conquest, non-Shang populations through time, as again would be the case in later periods? And if so, how were these other populations controlled? At this point, we have almost no archaeological data that would bear on these issues. The capital sites do show evidence of increasing levels of social organization and the steady rigidification of Shang society from 2000 to about 1000 BC. This involves a physical demarcation of space with urban clusters instead of compact urban areas and elites living in houses on rammed earth platforms. This may equate to a social organization around powerful descent groups, with royal and other lineages living in different areas. We'll talk about the ideologies of rule in early China in the next two lectures. And in my next lecture, I specifically want to talk about the development of Chinese writing systems, because this is very much relevant to these issues, these questions about Shang political systems. Thank you.